Welcome to Crime Suit Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Carter.
And I'm Hannah.
After 18 months of enduring harassment, vandalism, and death threats, a small-town Montana rancher mysteriously goes missing. His wife, in a desperate attempt to find her husband, digs into his past and discovers that he isn't who she thought he was. This is the story of Bo Tanner. Debbie and Bo Tanner married in the summer of 1986 and lived in Polebridge, Montana, a very small community near Glacier National Park. Debbie was from the state of Washington, but she would spend summers in Polebridge on her grandfather's 500-acre ranch and had dreams of reviving his ranch after he died in 1973. Together, Debbie and Bo were able to make that dream a reality by subleasing the acreage to other ranchers and raising their cattle. Within 3 months, they were the proud overseers of over 200 cows.
There is nothing suspicious, right?
Nothing suspicious right now. Nope.
Sitting here wondering, like, where's the story gonna go?
Does it have anything to do with the cows? What did the cows do? What have they seen? There were some concerns from within the Polebridge community that a working ranch would disturb the surrounding wilderness, opening up hayfields, cutting the meadows that deer and elk would graze on, felling trees to make fences, etc. To help keep the community at ease, Debbie and Bo tried to work with the townspeople as best as they could and always opened up their property to horseback riders and anyone else who wanted to use the land. Eventually, the couple also established a church on their property, which meant that the locals no longer needed to drive over 30 minutes to the nearest fellowship.
I've never been near Glacier, but where Debbie and Bo are. So I looked up Polebridge, Montana, and this isn't even a small town. This is a quote unquote rural community where there's not really businesses. It's really just big swaths of land. It's mostly ranch land. And then there's one business in town. It's the general store, which is actually where Debbie worked. But this isn't a town. This is just, I don't know about their particular house, but they were probably very far away from all of their neighbors.
Dang. That's not my cup of tea, personally.
Nathaniel and I lived out in rural Montana for 6 months, and it was the worst 6 months of my life. Because we were there from October to April, I think, which is the coldest part of the year. We essentially got there right before winter time, before the temperatures dropped, and then we stayed through calving season, and then we left. But it would get 30 below zero, and your car couldn't start. It was very cold, and our closest neighbors were probably a 5-minute walk, probably.
That sounds terrible. It's a no from me, personally. Not doing that.
No one can hear you scream.
Don't like that. I mean, I don't like the idea of my neighbors being able to hear me talking next to me, right next to my house, but I don't like the idea of nobody being able to hear me call for help either.
That's why you live in the suburbs.
The burbs. Born and raised, baby. Debbie and Bo Tanner's church was simply a large tent with yellow and white stripes. Hilarious that was included. Reminds me of a circus tent. But that was all that was needed to house the 20 or so patrons that frequented their services. Bo took responsibility for the Sunday meetings, ministering sermons, and by all accounts, the Tanners were loved members of the community. That is, until one morning in September 1989, when Debbie and Bo awoke to find their church tent had been savagely slashed overnight. 45 hymnals and Bibles were destroyed. Chairs were thrown about and damaged. The ropes that held the tent up were cut, which caused it to collapse. And here's where the mystery starts.
A little bit funny, you have to admit, that they're in such a rural community, which probably has 50 people tops, right?
Yeah.
And they've got how many patrons?
20 or so.
So probably half of their immediate neighbors go to this church.
And how many of them are old? Really old.
How many of them are elderly and probably couldn't have done
exactly.
It? Exactly. Can you imagine being a cop in this situation? You're like, well, it should be pretty easy to find out who did this, right?
Honestly,
there's only so many people it could be unless people are driving 3 hours to come to Polebridge to slash a church that they know nothing about. I just feel like the lineup would be pretty funny.
You're on like a road trip and you are driving by some rural town. You see like a circus tent out in the middle of a field. You're like,
absolutely not.
I'm going to fuck that up right there. Absolutely
not. No, what happened is someone thought the circus was in town, got all excited, went, and there's just a bunch of Bibles, and they're like, ugh.
Are you fucking kidding me? Okay, we slandered Idaho, but I don't know if I feel comfortable slandering, is it Montanans? People from Montana? I just live here. I don't live there, but I live here, and I don't know. Either way, I don't know enough about people from Montana to slander them, so I don't want to.
I know a lot about people from Montana, at least eastern Montana, and let me tell you, they deserve to be slandered. Here's my side rant.
Okay? Oh, no.
And this is just eastern Montana. Western Montana, I've heard, is very beautiful, and the culture might be different, but eastern Montana is, quote unquote, cowboy country, right? The land is cheap, and the people there, eastern Montana is, one, hideous. I'm not even going to apologize.
Damn, right for the throat.
It is true. It is so ugly. There is no landscape. Everything is brown. For the most part, it's flat, right? It's cheap land for your cattle to graze. And there's nothing to do. Everyone there is a rancher or is somehow involved in ranching. Either they're like a supplier. And so everyone's lives revolve around ranching, which ranching is like a 16 hours a day job. So people get up before the butt crack of dawn and then they go to bed or they end the work day way, way late, which is a miserable existence.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it is.
They've tricked themselves into believing that
it makes them superior in some way.
Yes. So they all think that they're superior because they're like hardworking folk, right? And it's like, yes, you are hardworking, and they are incredibly hardworking, and they get a ton of shit done, right? They work so many hours, but
that's their whole life.
It's like a form of self-harm, in my opinion, from working these long hours and not sleeping. And the only thing to do there, there's like a million casinos and bars.
Oh, so it's literally just coping mechanisms. It's literally just a state full of coping mechanisms for self-harm.
Yes.
People who self-harm on a daily basis as their job.
When I was only there for 6 months, and there were two different suicides while I was there.
Oh.
Like, the reason that people thrive out there, that they, I think, stay there long-term, is because they like not having close neighbors. They like the rural community setting where your closest neighbors is very far away. If you needed them, you could go get them. But for the most part, people are staunchly independent. None of them like asking for help.
That's a terrible culture. Whenever people are like that, it makes me think that they're deeply insecure.
Oh, yeah.
From what you've said, it sounds like at least Eastern Montanians made it their entire personality to be good at suffering.
Yes. Yes.
Like,
and I'm sure that they disagree. Like, they're going to hate this analysis, but that is my two cents. And they're very far away. What are they going to do? Drive all the way to Utah and kill me?
They're working 16-hour days on their cattle ranch.
They don't have time.
They don't have time.
They don't have time for arch nemeses.
Well, I hope that they find something that brings them joy in this life, because we're only here for a short time, and working like that, like, while it is necessary, I feel like there's just other things. There's got to be a better way. That's my opinion on lots of things. There's got to be a better way.
The whole time I was there, I wanted to just like shake them by the shoulders and be like, there are better places out there. Move, like leave this godforsaken wasteland.
Anyway, back to our story. Debbie and Beau wondered what motive someone would have to commit the vandalism. They weren't sure if someone didn't like the church or if someone didn't like them. There were no written messages or threats to explain why it was done. Debbie felt that it was violent and thorough enough to let them know that the perpetrator was not done. However, she and Beau refused to be intimidated. They moved the church to a nearby cabin donated by a local resident. Debbie said that she had not been a quitter while growing up, so she was not going to quit on the church. And right there is the quintessential Montana attitude that we talked about in the just before this. Build a new circus tent.
Except no, they improved. Now they're at a cabin.
At a cabin. Can't slash cabins. Almost a year later, disaster struck again. The church cabin went up in flames, and so did Beau and Debbie's dreams. The building was totally consumed by the fire. By the time it was extinguished, there was nothing left but piles of nails, broken foundation blocks, and melted glass. That's a hot fire. Detective Pat Walsh, along with the other detectives, felt that the fire was set deliberately. There was no reason for it to have happened accidentally, since there was no electricity or fuel in the cabin. I would be really, really confused and super freaked out if I were Debbie. And then, less than a month after their church cabin was destroyed, Debbie and Beau returned home after spending an evening with friends to find their house had been trashed. Not a single inch remained untouched. The intruder left a disturbing calling card, a warning. "Get out," scrawled on a newspaper, and a live bullet pointed straight at a photograph of Beau.
If they have any kind of neighbors at all, they would see people coming and going.
I don't know how they didn't. What is happening? Like, yeah.
Everyone would know, like, yeah, I saw so-and-so's car driving to the Tanner's house. I feel like somebody knows. Or maybe it is one of their immediate neighbors and just...
I'm sure they just didn't see anything out of the ordinary.
Maybe this is all just how funny it would be if you thought that there was someone like after your life, but actually everything's just explained away, like, oh, the tent wasn't slashed, cows just got to it and chewed through the canvas and ate all the Bibles, because they do that. And it's like, oh, the cabin wasn't burned by an arson, it was just the cow kicked over the kerosene lamp. The house wasn't trashed, just some sheep got in. That's Montana life for you.
Just Montana things.
I thought someone was after my... Oh, wait, but didn't they leave a...
Yeah, they left... The cows left a note.
Get out. Dead. They're real sophisticated out in Montana.
The cows have had enough. When cows strike back.
This is like a Gary Larson cartoon.
This would be a hilarious Far Side cartoon, like very hilarious. We underestimate cows. Detective Pat Walsh arrived the following day with a team of investigators and fingerprinted the crime scene. In order to help isolate the perpetrator's fingerprints, Beau scheduled to meet with Detective Walsh back at the station and Kalispell to provide his own fingerprint samples. On Tuesday, September 4th, 1990, Beau dropped his wife Debbie off for work at the local general store, telling her that he needed to drive an hour into the nearest town of Columbia Falls to buy routine supplies for the ranch. He was also scheduled to meet with Detective Walsh in Kalispell, another 30 minutes drive, so Beau told Debbie he wouldn't be home until 5 or 6 p.m. There's this couple on the internet. I don't remember which part of the internet, but they live in like a super in the middle of nowhere town in Alaska, I think. Mm-hmm. And they have to drive 5 hours to get groceries. That's insane. Yeah,
that's exactly how it was when I lived in Eastern Montana. So like there were grocery stores in town, but Billings was the closest large city, quote unquote, large city, which I think was like 3 hours.
I would hate that. Hate it. Okay.
I hated that when I lived in Miles City, there were only two gynecologists in town and they were both men.
Hate that too.
And only one of them took my insurance and he had the biggest hands I've ever seen. We called him Dr. Big Hands. I hated him.
Oh my
I hope
God.
He's listening.
Fuck you, Dr. Big Hands.
Montanans shouldn't be allowed to leave Montana. We should lock them in as a safety against the rest of us.
Oh my God. Everything we've said up
they
to
are
that
not
point.
Well adjusted.
Everything we've said up to that point, I think, can be forgivable. But I think Montanans would drive from Montana to Utah to get you for saying that. Like, out of pure spite. So.
Nah, they can't leave their cows that long.
They have enough money to hire hitmen, Hannah. Around noon, Debbie received a call from Beau telling her that he was having car trouble and would probably be home later than he originally anticipated. But Beau never returned home that night, and when Debbie contacted police, she discovered that he also never made it to Kalispell for his appointment with Detective Walsh. Debbie and her friends, along with the police, searched every road and footpath around Polebridge. When 2 days had passed and no trace of Beau or his car were found, Debbie was convinced that he had been killed by whoever trashed their house and left that threatening note.
How is she supposed to get home? He took the car.
Yeah. He was killed, Hannah. He's dead. It was a cow.
Okay, what happens to Beau Tanner? I gotta know.
Okay, chill out. I'll keep going. On September 7th, 3 days after Beau vanished, Debbie's world changed forever. She received a letter from Beau, which said that he was not coming back. He started out with, "By now, I'm sure you hate me. I love you a lot. I don't expect you to understand it, but I do love you with all of my being. I have to leave. I'm going to go back to see my family. I don't expect you to understand, but I have to be where my family is, in Texas," end quote. At the end of the letter, he said, "P.S. You've probably found the car at the airport by now. Here's the key." His car was indeed later found at Glacier Park International Airport.
On top of, let's say, your husband of several years, right, up and leaves you with nothing more than a note, he just sneaks off, leaves the car at the airport, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you have a cattle ranch with 200 cows.
200 freaking cows to take care of.
And he left you without a car.
And I have work.
Can't.
Debbie was extremely heartbroken when Beau left. He was her best friend, her lover, and her world. Obviously, like, what the heck? She went back to the store and sorted through her other mail and found a bank statement which showed that almost a month before Beau left, he took out $4,000, emptying their savings account. Absolutely f***ing not. He just rubbed salt into the wound. Despite the fact that he had deserted her, Debbie never gave up searching for Beau. 6 months after his disappearance, Debbie traveled to Utah, where he had once lived, and tried to find any information she could, showing his picture to everyone she met. She not only found that others knew and remembered Beau, but learned that he had another name, Jim Holloway. He also had been married to a woman from Emory, Utah named Lenora. Debbie tracked down Lenora and learned the very unfortunate truth about her missing husband's past.
So Beau is actually named Jim Holloway, right?
Yep. Lenora explained that her and Beau's divorce was not finalized until August 1987. Meanwhile, Debbie and Beau were married in August 1986. I didn't even know that you could get married again before your divorce was finalized, but I guess you can if it's under a different name.
I bet his name wasn't even changed. How much you want to bet he literally just changed his name verbally? Like, he just started walking around going, "I think I like the name Beau now." And then it was just put on all of his documents.
That had to be exactly it. I firmly believe it. The cops were
like, "What's your name, son?" He's like, "Beau Tanner." They're like, "Nice to meet you, Beau Tanner."
Yeah.
And then it was legally binding. And
then, that's it. That's how you change your name. Back in the 80s. Oh, but get this. Also, Beau had been married at least 5 times, and 4 of those relationships ended abruptly, ending without even a divorce. So,
this is what Lenora told her?
Yes. So when he walked out on wife number 2, he cleverly used his own car to create a bogus murder scene and used animal blood to make it look like he had been killed.
Okay, that's kind of creative. I'll give him props for that. I mean, who hasn't thought about doing that?
Faking my own murder?
Yes. You know how many times I've thought about how much easier life would be if I faked my own death? I would be free. Not like from my family, like, but like
from responsibility. From the government.
I wouldn't have to pay taxes anymore.
Yeah, and your family could collect take out a big insurance policy. We are not encouraging this, by the way. Do not sue us. We're just thinking out loud.
We're just spitballing.
Yeah, just having some thoughts. Totally innocent thoughts. Who hasn't had these thoughts?
I can't be the only one.
No, I'm sure you're not.
I guarantee you there's people out there who have successfully faked their own deaths and they're just like living their best lives.
I mean,
D.B. Cooper.
I have no idea who that is.
He jumped out of a plane and was never seen again. May or may not be alive. I don't. He had a briefcase full of money, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I don't know how one jumps out of a plane and survives without a parachute.
With a parachute.
Oh, he jumped out with a parachute?
Yeah.
Oh, and then shit, that's all he had to say.
A bunch of money and has never been seen.
Living the dream.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that's what Beau's been trying to do, but he's not very good at it.
He sucks. Sucks ass at this. First of all, he told her where he was going. He was going to Texas.
He's not very smart.
No, this idiot was like, "She's not going to follow me." What? And Debbie was like, "Absolutely the f*** not. I'm going to find out where you are." And she's hella smart. She didn't even go straight to Texas. She went to where he last lived before she met him. So she's a real one for that.
Yeah, Debbie will find you.
Yeah, she's coming for your ass.
She's probably still around. Debbie, if you're listening, mad respect.
We salute you. In the fall of 1991, police discovered that Beau's real name was Eddie Dale Riddlehoover. He was born real life.
I'm sorry,
Riddler.
Say that again.
Eddie Dale Riddlehoover.
One more time.
Did I say it wrong? Eddie?
No, I just think his name's hilarious.
Eddie Dale Riddlehoover.
Riddle Hoover. Okay, so he's not Jim Holloway.
Not Jim Holloway and not Bo Tanner. His real Christian name was Eddie Dale Riddle Hoover.
Now I understand why he changed.
He was born on April 3rd, 1951 in Houston, Texas. He was also a Vietnam veteran. A fingerprint found in his home in Pulbridge was matched to the one on Riddle Hoover's military card. That's why he never went to... That's why he never went to Kalispell to get his fingerprints. He's like, these aren't catching me now after all this time.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. So, yeah, he's got a fingerprint on his whatever card.
Military card. Yeah. So he was probably never going to go to Kalispell when...
It's a good thing I don't have one of those.
Yeah.
Have you been fingerprinted?
Yes, because I worked with... I was a Boy Scout leader.
Oh, to make sure you weren't like a child molester.
Exactly. So I kind of regret getting fingerprinted.
I feel like if I had managed to avoid that, then I could have committed crimes in the future.
Not if I burn my fingerprints off first.
That's true. We should do an episode on that.
Yeah, we should.
We'll make a DIY channel how to burn off your fingerprints.
Commit crimes.
Instead of as a true crime podcast, now it's just a crime podcast.
We never specified what crime soup actually meant.
You live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Okay, continuing on. Eddie Riddle Hoover graduated from Deer Park High School in Texas in 1969. Nice. And got married at the age of 20. Sorry. I couldn't help it. Something came over me and I had to.
The spirit of Eddie Dale Riddle Hoover came over you.
I can't imagine he was that funny.
Probably not.
He dipped out.
I'm going to post his picture, by the way. He was actually pretty cute. So I can understand how he managed to swindle five women. I might be one of them.
In the only picture I found of him, he looked like a freaking... He looked like, what's his name, from Stranger Things.
Oh, so older pictures of him, no. He's like started to bald and whatever. But if you look up his like high school senior picture, he's adorable.
I don't think he could swindle me.
Have I not sent it to you? I'm going to text it to you right now.
Yeah, send it to me. Okay, I'm going to. And got married at the age of 20 to an 18-year-old woman named Luann Childs. Eddie and Luann were legally married for 7 years and had two children together. What happened next is still very unclear, most likely because Eddie used several different aliases, but it seemed that Eddie would seek out relationships with women, marry them, and then instead of simply divorcing them, would either mysteriously disappear or fake his own death. Between his first marriage in 1971 and his marriage to Debbie in 1986, it's believed that Eddie was married at least five times. For those doing the math, that's five marriages in 15 years. How does anybody have that much time on their hands? Like, that sounds exhausting, to be honest.
Having five wives?
Having that many marriages in that short of time. Like, getting to know people is exhausting.
Yeah, that's like a whole nother aspect of the story that, I mean, we don't really have an answer to, which is like, what was he hoping to accomplish? Like, was he marrying these women for a specific reason? Did he just have commitment issues? Was there anything actually wrong with his relationships? Or did he just get, like, antsy and was like... He wanted to get out of there. Did he actually love these women? Like, do you think he actually loved these women or it was just kind of like a fun game for him? Do you think he felt any kind of remorse for what he did?
I don't think he liked doing this. I think my guess, I guess from my limited perspective on this, from what I can see, it sounds like this was really stressful for him. And the work that he put into it was minimal. Like, yeah, he put a lot of effort into making it look like he was a victim and making it look like he was murdered, but it didn't look like he was having fun doing it. Like, it sounded like he was trying to get out of doing something, get out of the relationship for whatever reason.
This part doesn't make sense. I mean, a lot of it is weird, but the part that doesn't make sense to me is his marriage with Debbie. He slashed his own church tent. He burnt his own cabin. He trashed his own house, right? And those wouldn't make Debbie leave him, right? If his end goal was to get away from Debbie, to leave his marriage, that doesn't make any sense. Because if someone's assaulting you, if someone's leaving Get Out and live bullet rounds and stuff, then they would have left together, right? Because if someone was threatening my husband, I wouldn't leave him. I would leave with him and we would go somewhere else.
But maybe he doesn't understand that.
Well, it makes me think that maybe the problem with his marriage to Debbie wasn't actually Debbie, but was actually the ranch, that he wanted to leave the ranch. He didn't want to be a rancher anymore. And so he was trying to get Debbie to leave with him. And when she didn't, when she kept being like, we can work through this, bro. We're tougher than these folks, right?
Yeah.
He was like, I gotta go.
Yeah, that was a lot of cattle to take care of. Like, And he became a preacher. Like, he probably bit off more than he could chew. And I feel like, okay, this is a very Kaylee thing to do, where somebody's like, hey, we should do this really big thing that's a lot of responsibility.
We should start a podcast.
We should take care of 200 cattle. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds rad. I could totally do that. And then I look everything up and I'm like, oh yeah, I could totally do that. And then I start doing it and I'm like, I've made a huge mistake. This is so much more difficult than I thought it would be. How do I get out of this? So maybe he was feeling similarly about his own commitments that he had made, and he didn't have the coping mechanisms to address them like an adult should. And so he resorted to faking his own death and trying to bully himself out of communities.
Well, and also, like, the part about him faking his own death, to a certain degree, it does make a tiny bit of sense, where I think he's trying to make himself... He's trying to absolve himself of guilt.
Yes.
He's trying to make himself look like the victim, mm-hmm. so that the people around him can't be mad at him. Because you can't be mad at someone who's dead, or you can't be mad at someone who committed suicide, or you can't be mad at someone who got hit by a car, or whatever fake death he's staging.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think deep down he felt bad for leaving these women.
I agree. Which makes me think that he really did love Debbie. He really cared about her, at least in some type of way. Not enough to do the right thing or treat her like he should have treated her. But
not enough to not take all of her life savings and leave her in the middle of Montana.
Literally, without a car or anybody to help with the commitments that he made, for the love of all things holy and God herself, please go to therapy. Okay, this is the best part of the story right here. So, Debbie's story was aired on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries on November 27th, 1991, which is eventually what helped track Eddie down to his new residence in Wyoming. Thanks to viewers' tips, Debbie was able to locate Eddie, also aka Bo Tanner, in Douglas, Wyoming. He was living there under the name John J.D. Terrell. On January 30th, 1992, she confronted him at a restaurant in Douglas, where he was accompanied by his new girlfriend. Other patrons of the restaurant recognized Bo and Debbie from the broadcast and called the police. This is like a real live sitcom. They were watching it in real time. Like, what a blessing. This would have been amazing.
Dude, I would pay so much money if I could be in that restaurant on that evening when Debbie walks into the restaurant knowing that her husband, who abandoned her years previously, is there with his new girlfriend. Like, are they going to fight? What's going to happen?
I want a recreation of this scene, but it's filmed like the Kardashians, because that would be fucking hilarious.
Yeah, if this was like a made-for-TV movie, I'd watch it.
Yeah, for sure. Bo and Debbie about to throw down. One woman even called the telecenter and said that she had been married to Eddie, claiming that he faked his suicide in 1978 to avoid an arson investigation. What in the hell did he do? He abandoned his car on a bridge above a Houston ship channel, apparently to make it look like he had jumped to his death. This man has no respect for anybody or anything. Like, And what arson investigation? What? What did he do?
What did he burn down?
I mean, we know for sure he did burn down his cabin, so...
Yeah.
So maybe something similar to that. This man has some emotional
damage. I'm trying to figure out the timeline, because he married Debbie in 86.
Mm-hmm.
His divorce to Lenora, is that her name?
Yeah.
His divorce to Lenora was finalized in 87.
Yeah. Right?
This is this woman who called into the telecenter, which is hilarious, by the way. Like, not funny to her, I'm sure.
No.
But like, to the rest of us, can you imagine, like, you're watching TV and you're like, hey, that's my piece of shit ex-husband.
I thought that fucker died.
Right? Oh, did she think he was still dead?
That's what it sounds like.
I want all of his ex-wives in a group chat.
Yes.
And I want to be in that group chat.
Take them all on Dr. Phil.
Yes. Dude, that would be the best episode ever.
Yes, it would be.
Call up Dr. Philip. What's his name?
Dr. Phyllis.
Huckabee? What's his name?
Huckabee?
What's his last name?
What? I have no idea. But that man's first name is Doctor and his last name is Phil. That's all I know.
Hold on. I'm looking it up right now. What is Dr. Phil's real name? McGraw. Like
Tim McGraw?
Is that the name of the true crime dog?
What?
Anyways, yes, I think that all of Beau's ex-wives, however many there are, because there might be more than five.
Seriously, maybe he did fake his death in really good ways and people really did think he died.
Yeah. Maybe I've been married to him. Who knows?
Oh, my God. Ladies, check your men's birth certificates. Is this your man?
Nathaniel's is. Just kidding. I think I have it somewhere. I think that's his real name.
Better double check.
Can you imagine finding out that James, that it wasn't, one, it wasn't his real name, and two, he'd been married five times before?
And he faked his death to get out of all of those marriages?
I mean, you would be flattered because he spent the longest with you, obviously. He's like, I like this Kaylee chick. I'm not even going to fake my death this time.
Which is absolutely insane to me because I am for sure the most insane person he's ever dated, let alone married. So, like,
maybe you figured it out. Maybe none of these women were crazy enough for him. Maybe he needed like a real psycho. He was like, these women are too normal and wholesome.
I would have held him down.
I need someone that's batshit crazy. I guarantee that's what it was.
Absolutely
not.
These
women aren't crazy enough for me. They're not on my level.
That sucks ass. Like, that. I hate that.
That's what you get for being normal, Debbie.
How dare you expect an emotionally stable human to come into your life and be your husband? What a life. Well, thanks to Debbie's dogged pursuit of her husband, Eddie. Eddie was found and his past was brought to light. Debbie was also able to get answers about the man she was married to, and she was finally able to get a divorce from him.
And here's the real cherry on top is that Eddie Dale Riddlehoover, a.k.a. Jim Holloway, a.k.a. Beau Tanner, and whatever other names he's used, has never been charged with any criminal offenses.
Where is he today?
I don't know. Should we get him on the line?
Yeah. I would like to know. I would like to know what prompted the unnecessary audacity in all of these situations.
I have one question, and that is, what was the arson investigation in 1978?
I have one question, and my question is simply, why? Why? Crime Soup listeners, thank you for tuning into this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on social media and let us know your thoughts on this crazy case. You can find us on Instagram at crime_soup and on TikTok at Crime Soup Podcast. Tune in next Tuesday for your next helping of delicious crime soup. Bon appetit!